The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, April 2nd, 2025. I'm your host, Vicki Iden.
And I'm your host, Robert McClure. In tonight's news, a thumping rejection of Elon Musk's money and a drubbing for Republicans as Dane County Judge Susan Crawford heads to the state Supreme Court.
The Madison Common Council has some new faces.
And in the second half, student reporters measure student sentiment towards political races. We revisit some headlines from 60 years ago, plus every possible detail about the weather for the upcoming weekend.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. President Trump has announced sweeping new tariffs on almost all goods entering the United States, with major implications for global trade. In a speech in the Rose Garden of the White House, he said the date would be remembered as Liberation Day, when prosperity returned to America. The measures include a minimum tax of 10% on all imports, with higher rates for those from trading partners like the European Union. The bloc, he said, was ripping off the United States.
European Union, they're very tough, very, very tough traders. You think of European Union, very friendly. They rip us off. It's so sad to see. It's so pathetic.
Service in Milwaukee Sullivan has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Rock County in south central Wisconsin, southeastern Dane County in south central Wisconsin, until 6:30 p.m. At 6 p.m., a severe thunderstorm capable of producing a tornado was located over Evansville, moving northeast at 45 miles an hour. Hazard: tornado. Source: weather spotters reported funnel cloud. Impact: flying debris will be dangerous to those caught without shelter. Mobile homes will be damaged or destroyed. Damage to roofs, windows, and vehicles will occur. Tree damage is likely. Locations impacted include Fulton, Indian Fort, Edgerton, Cooksville, Albion, Utica, Evansville, and Stoughton. Take cover now. Move to a basement or an interior room on the lowest floor of a sturdy building. Avoid windows. If you are outdoors, in a mobile home, or in a vehicle, move to the closest substantial shelter and protect yourself from flying debris.
In the wake of Friday's devastating earthquake, the Army had faced international criticism for continuing to fight despite the disaster. The BBC's Agita Lamaya traveled undercover to reach Mandalay, the biggest city near the epicenter.
What you're hearing there is the sound of an electrical drill through which they're drilling through the concrete slabs.
We're seeing lots of places where there is just no rescue work going on.
Nan Chin Hain has been waiting on this street for 5 days, hoping someone will come and search for her son, Sai Han Pan.
I'm just holding on, hoping to see my son's face. Whether he's dead or alive, I just want to see his body.
BBC News. The Prime Minister of Denmark, Mette Frederiksen, is visiting Greenland's capital Nuuk to support the island during what she called a difficult time. President Trump has repeatedly said he would like to take control of the semi-autonomous Danish territory. On arrival, Ms. Frederiksen said the U.S. would not take over Greenland, which she said belonged to Greenlanders. Activists in Sudan say at least 85 people have been killed during a series of raids by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The Sudanese Resistance Committee says for 7 days the RSF have targeted villages south of the capital Khartoum. Videos show groups of people, including many women and children, walking over a bridge on the River Nile in search of safety. The former president of Costa Rica, Oscar Arias, says he has had his U.S. visa revoked weeks after he said Donald Trump was behaving like a Roman emperor. Mr. Arias, who is 84, won the Nobel Peace Prize for helping negotiate peace deals in Central America in the 1980s. Leonardo Rocha has more details.
Mr. Arias has been a staunch critic of some of the Trump administration's policies, including its stance against migration and its decision to impose trade tariffs on imports. In February, he accused the current Costa Rican government of taking orders directly from Washington. He referred specifically to a decision by President Rodrigo Chavez to exclude Chinese companies from contracts to develop Costa Rica's 5G mobile phone network.
The Slovak cabinet has approved a plan to kill about a quarter of the country's brown bears after a spate of attacks on humans. Announcing the plan to cull 350 bears, the Prime Minister Robert Fico said people couldn't live in a country where they were afraid to go into the woods.
Good evening. This is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
All eyes were on Wisconsin last night for the first major contest since President Trump returned to the White House, and voters overwhelmingly elected liberal candidate Susan Crawford to the state Supreme Court. Crawford beat conservative candidate Brad Schimmel by 10 percentage points, so much that pollsters were confident in calling the race much earlier than is typical in statewide elections. While Wisconsin's judicial election in 2023 set records as the most expensive court race in U.S. history, this year's race blew that record out of the water, with a total spending clocking in at more than $100 million, according to an analysis from Isthmus newspaper. Seats on the court are technically nonpartisan, but a flood of out-of-state cash and high-profile endorsements turned the race into a referendum on Trump and his billionaire ally Elon Musk, who himself poured millions into the race. Crawford didn't just make strides in blue areas of the state, she also secured a majority in 10 counties that voted for Trump just 5 months ago. For more, we turn it over to WORT news producer Faye Parks, who was on the ground last night at Susan Crawford's watch party at the Park Hotel in downtown Madison.
That was the crowd last night at the Park Hotel, learning for the first time that Susan Crawford was officially projected to win the race for state Supreme Court. The announcement came unusually early, just over an hour after polls closed across the state. Music was blasting, drinks were flowing, and Crawford supporters chanted her name when she took the podium. Flanked by her fellow liberal justices, Crawford vowed to advance fairness and common sense on the Supreme Court. She also took one last dig at her opponent, Brad Schimmel, and his ties to tech billionaire Elon Musk, who invested more than $21 million into Schimmel's campaign.
But I've got to tell you, as a little girl growing up in Chippewa Falls, I never could have imagined that I'd be taking on the richest man in the world. Justice in Wisconsin. And we won!
Musk's financial meddling was a common refrain at last night's watch party. Here's State Representative Lisa Subek, a Democrat from Madison.
Tonight's a real victory for all of Wisconsin, but it's also a real victory for all of the nation. I mean, I have been hearing from friends and family around the country, and they say, our eyes are on Wisconsin. What's happening? What's happening? And, you know, we saw huge money coming in from Elon Musk, out of, not just out of state money, but Elon Musk money. And I think that the people stood up and said, we don't want that.
Making my way through the crowd, I asked folks if they had a message for Elon Musk, and by extension, the Trump administration. Notable radio personality Dr. Zorba Pastor kicks things off.
It begins with the letter F.
Stay out of our local elections. You have gone way too far already with the federal, but you cannot stop us in the local. We are here, we are organizing, we have grassroots on the ground, we have students mobilizing, and we will not take big money sitting quietly.
We're not for sale. We're not for sale. Nice try, but don't do it again.
We don't want this divisiveness. We don't want the money. We don't want any of those things. Like, we want good people doing good work.
Elon Musk can buy rockets and buy a lot of other things, but he can't buy Wisconsin voters. And that was sent loud and clear. And look, like, Wisconsinites are the hardest working people that I know. And they don't want some billionaire to manipulate who's going to control our highest court. Brad Schimmel was for sale, and Wisconsin voters didn't buy it.
That last speaker was Wisconsin's Secretary of State, Sarah Godlewski. She added last night that Crawford's win also gives state Democrats breathing room to plan for the future and advance their values.
Well, we are now so lucky to have a Supreme Court that actually believes in rights and our democracy. And so I want our court to continue that trajectory. We've got an 1849 abortion ban that's still on the books, and that is time for that to go. You know, we have the right to collectively bargain, and that has been taken away. We have seen how our rights to clean drinking water have been taken away as corporations are not being held accountable, to even ensuring the rights to marry who you love. And so it's all on the line, and I really believe that this Supreme Court is going to respect liberty in our Constitution and make those rights even stronger.
State Senator Kelda Royce, a Democrat from Madison, was also at last night's watch party. She says that the first item on her agenda is to reform Wisconsin's campaign finance laws.
The amount of money that Elon Musk, one person, was able to spend on this election is appalling. And people need to have confidence in our judicial system. We can't do that if it feels like justice is for sale. I mean, my God, this man resorted to bribing voters and violating our laws brazenly. We cannot allow that. So I'm going to be introducing in the coming days legislation to try to rein in the kind of abuses of campaign finance law that we have seen in the Supreme Court election.
The state Supreme Court flipped to a liberal majority in 2023. Crawford's win last night cements a liberal majority for at least the next 3 years, until 2028. Liberals could add to that majority next spring, when conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley's 10-year term expires. Meanwhile, state Democrats are already looking forward to the midterms in 2026. Thanks to Wisconsin's new legislative maps, they successfully narrowed the Republican majority in both chambers this November. Representative Subek says Democrats are poised to actually flip control of the state legislature if they take advantage of the lessons they learned from Crawford's campaign.
The people spoke here, and I think this was because Wisconsinites stood up and fought. I was out knocking doors with neighborhood teams of people who were out knocking, talking neighbor to neighbor. And that is how we win elections. We should continue to do that. And I think we should listen to what the people of Wisconsin said with their votes today, just they value democracy, they value our freedoms, and they expect us as Democrats to stand up and fight for that.
For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
In the other statewide race on the ballot last night, Jill Underley won re-election to her office as state superintendent, where she'll serve out another 4 years, heading up the Department of Public Instruction. Underley won with 52.9% of the vote, defeating her rival Brittany Kinzer by more than 126,000 votes statewide. Prior to her position in politics, Underly worked in education for 20 years as a high school social studies teacher, an elementary school principal, a school district administrator, and at other positions in the DPI. Though this race was nonpartisan on paper, Underly was backed by Democrats while Kinzer was backed by Republicans. This is the most expensive campaign for superintendent to date. Spending in the race exceeded $4.5 million. Underly spoke with WORT's Tony Castaneda last night at Susan Crawford's watch party.
It was a little closer race for you than it was for Susan Crawford. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, there was a lot of money in this race, in the DPI race. It was the first time, I think, that we've had so much outside money. I was outspent. I think that that also had a big impact on the outcome, too.
Okay, but how are you feeling, though?
I feel great. I think at the end of the day, I mean, Wisconsinites love their public schools, and that's the message that mattered.
What do you think about Susan Crawford's victory?
I'm relieved. I'm excited for, you know, her to be on the bench. I mean, there's a lot of things that we need to do in public education land that we need to make sure that Susan's on the bench in order to be successful. Like school funding, for example, is a big piece. You know, when we look at our teachers, we look at Act 10, I think that there's a lot of decisions that are going to be made that are going to impact public education.
Were you concerned about the criticism that you were getting from some folks, especially in the Democratic primary and your opponent and what they were saying? And what is your vision now as the superintendent of the public schools?
I think we all want the same things. You know, I think the people who voted are still public school people. You know, I think that they care about their communities. They care about the kids in their communities. Public schools are the schools that accept every kid. So at the end of the day, I stand by the fact that we all want the same things.
What do you think about Elon Musk and Trump making this a statement on their policies and what they're doing and the fact that they're pretty much slapped down pretty hard?
Well, I think they have an agenda, and that agenda is to, you know, take public dollars, the U.S. Department of Education, turn it into, you know, school vouchers, and I think that that message didn't land well here in Wisconsin.
Also, in yesterday's election, Wisconsinites approved enshrining voter ID requirements into the state's constitution. With more than 60% saying yes to the referendum, the Associated Press called the vote soon after polls closed. The law requiring registered voters to show valid ID at the polls has been on the books since 2011 and remains unchanged after the referendum. But now, the law is enshrined in Wisconsin's constitution. That means it's protected from court challenges and can't be removed by mere legislation. The only way to undo it is through another amendment process, which requires passing the legislature in two consecutive sessions and then putting it to the voters, as was done yesterday. While the legislature cannot overturn the law, it can determine which types of identification qualify for voting. The legislature also retains the authority to establish rules for additional exceptions, like issuing provisional ballots. Voter ID laws are currently on the books in 36 states across the country. A Marquette Law School poll showed that elevating the state voter ID law to constitutional status was highly popular among all Wisconsin voters, including a majority of Democrats polled.
Meanwhile, Dane County Executive Melissa Agard has won a full term to the office. She appeared on the ballot in November to fill out the remaining term of former executive Joe Parisi. In that election, she faced one challenger after having beaten two others in the primary. And last night, she easily bested yet one more, DeForest businessman Stephen Ratzlaff. Executive Agard received about 4/5 of the vote across Dane County. That's a higher margin of victory than she received in November.
And turnout across Dane County was high last night. Just under 70% of registered voters cast a ballot, whether absentee or in person yesterday. That's according to an unofficial canvas, and those numbers might change slightly after reconciliation. But it's about 7.5 percentage points higher, the turnout, than even spring of 2023, which also featured a high-profile and high-stakes matchup between a liberal and conservative for state Supreme Court. This time around, Dane County saw just over 45,600 more votes than in spring of 2023. The number of people registered to vote has also swelled by 25,000. Last night, Judge Crawford gained 85% of Kamala Harris's total in Dane County last November, but only 61% of the Trump vote came out for Judge Schimmel last night, according to an analysis from the New York Times. Still, a drubbing across the state, Crawford's percentage of the Harris vote was higher than Schimmel's share of the Trump vote in every single county across the state.
Here in the city of Madison and Dane County, election officials say outside of some student rushes on the UW-Madison campus, polling places were relatively calm yesterday. According to City Clerk Michael Haas, who is filling in while Madison Clerk Mary Beth Witzelbell is on leave, told reporters that extra procedures were in place to ensure all ballots were counted. That says the city faces a lawsuit for not counting nearly 200 absentee ballots last November. In Milwaukee last night, 7 voting sites ran out of ballots, causing longer lines and waits amid historic turnout. But Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald says that type of scenario isn't possible in our county.
Here, you're never going to run out of ballots. We have two kinds of ballots. We have regular pre-printed ballots. That's the kind we mail out for absentee, and that's the kind we hand out at the polls on election day. I'm sure you guys all know what I'm talking about. They have everything written on it. But then we also have what's called express vote ballots. They're blank, and they're smaller. They go in the ADA accessible machine, and you can touch screen, and it'll print who you voted for, and then that is also a ballot. Since they're blank, and we have a lot of those, we don't run out of ballots. Every polling place has one of these machines. And when we have a situation where there's a particular line at one polling place, we can put 2-3 express votes and speed that up right there.
All 20 seats of the Madison City Council were on the ballot last night. Nearly 3/4 of the council had competitive elections. WORT reporter Dane Bulow has the lowdown.
When Madison Alder Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford suspended her campaign in January, she endorsed her competitor, Ryan Coughlin, but she remained on the ballot for the East Side's District 15. And last night, without campaigning, she won by 219 votes. Today, she tells WORT,
"Wow, I'm humbled and honored to have been reelected after I suspended my campaign in January. I did not expect it. I'm really grateful, and at the current moment, I have no further comment."
And on the west side in District 19, an almost upset. Incumbent Alder John Ugair won against challenger Nino Amato by just 9 votes. By that thin of a margin, Amato qualifies for a free recount. Amato tells WORT today that he would take that opportunity.
"And like anybody else, we'll play this thing out and go from there."
The Madison's clerk's office says that there are 4 provisional ballots, making this a nigh impossible feat for an Amato win. But even if multiple ballots are flipped in a recount, it's unclear if Amato could take office due to residence requirements. Amato blames the city clerk's office for bad advice, claiming it to be a mistake on their end.
"I get a notice on a Friday afternoon at 4:30 in the afternoon that, oops, we made a mistake. And they admit that in the email. Oops, we made a mistake. You have to have 28 days residency. But they only informed me with 25 days in the month."
Meanwhile, 2 newcomers beat out sitting alders running for election. On Madison's Northside District 12, challenger Julia Matthews beat out incumbent Amani Vladimir Burris by 471 votes. It was a rematch of the 2023 spring election between the two. This time around, Matthews managed to get 604 more votes than she did in 2023. In the West Side, District 9, sitting Alder Nikki Conklin was seeking re-election, only to be beaten by challenger Joanne Pritchett by 184 votes. Still, 7 incumbents were successful in hanging onto their seats despite a challenger, but some just squeaked by. In District 4, which covers the heart of the isthmus, including Capitol Square, longtime Alder Mike Verveer won re-election after facing challenger Eli Surovsky. Verveer, who was first elected Alder in 1995, had a 381-vote margin over Surovsky. Here's Mike Verveer.
"I am extremely excited to continue to doing the work that I've been doing all these many years to make our community a better place, especially for those that live downtown. A lot of unfinished business, a lot of work that needs to be done, a lot of challenges that continue to face our community."
On the Near West Side's District 10, Jeanette Figueroa-Cole battled for her re-election against longtime city staffer Lisa Vildrin. Figueroa-Cole won by 332 votes. In even more of a squeaker-off, the southern part of the Beltline, Isidore Knox Jr. and Noah Lieberman held their long-awaited rematch from 2023, which had resulted in a recount and eventual tie, before a game of chance in Knox's favor. This time, Knox Jr. had more of a margin. He won by 141 votes. On the West Side, District 5, incumbent Alder Regina Vidiver will serve her third term on the council. She beat out newcomer Ulrika Dieterle by 2,400 votes. In District 13, by Lake Wingra, incumbent Tag Evers easily fended off a challenge from Rob Luther. Evers won the seat by a landslide of 4,806 votes. It'll be his fourth term. East of the Dane County Airport, Alder Sabrina Madison sought her re-election against Sean Burke. Madison won by 2,433 votes. On the Southwest Side, Alder Barbara Harrington McKinney raced for her re-election in District 20 against Sammy Kilgee. Harrington McKinney won by 2,605 votes. But a handful of incumbents decided not to run again, letting in a wave of newcomers. In the heavily student District 2, where Alder Jelena Bennett wasn't seeking a third term, newcomer Willa Hovich beat out another newcomer, Matt Egger, by 850 votes. Far southwest of Madison, District 7, Alder Nasser Wahelie also wasn't seeking a third term. But her husband, Abdi Siad, was seeking his first term. Challenger Badri Lankela won out by 480 votes. To the far east side of Madison, beyond Monona, was a fight for District 16. J.L. Curry wasn't seeking a third term, so Sean O'Brien and Kim Richmond fought for the seat. O'Brien won by 1,608 votes. And on the north side of Madison, Alder Charles Meadze wasn't seeking a third term after facing a censure by his peer along with criminal charges. Newcomers Carmela Glenn and Kevin A. Monroe took up the battle. Glenn won by over 3,300 votes. Still a quarter of the council, that's five seats, were uncompetitive. In District 6, Davey Meyer is new to the council. He was unopposed in his election after longtime Alder Marsha Rummel decided not to run again. Meyer and Rummel ran against each other in 2023. Four other incumbents coasted by: John Duncan of District 1, Derek Field of District 3, MGR Govindarajan of District 8, and Bill Tischler, District 11, will still be familiar faces, re-elected with no challenger. Alders in even-numbered districts will be back on the ballot next spring. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Dane Bulow.
The election yesterday generally went off without incident, but nerves and energy did spill over on some UW campuses yesterday. A professor at UW-Eau Claire has been placed on administrative leave after an election-related altercation, reports the Wisconsin Journal Sentinel. He reportedly flipped a table set up by a student chapter of the College Republicans after the group had finished setting up near a polling place. And in Madison, a man was arrested last night after driving a Cybertruck onto the Library Mall near two separate polling locations. State Representative Francesca Hong reportedly witnessed the event and posted to social media. According to her posts, the driver threw drug paraphernalia out his window while screaming, "Free weed."
Meanwhile, last night, also on the UW-Madison campus, as the last hours of voting wound down, an event featuring former President Joe Biden's ambassador to the UN was interrupted by protesters over the ongoing horror in Gaza. Linda Thomas Greenfield served as the U.S. ambassador to the UN under former President Joe Biden. She received her Master's of Public Administration from UW-Madison. She was on the UW-Madison campus in a conversation hosted by the La Follette School of Public Affairs, billed as, quote, "the art of negotiation," unquote. Those skills were put to the test after protesters from a number of groups, including UW-Madison Students for Justice in Palestine, interrupted. The exchange lasted over 10 minutes. Here's an excerpt of what the former UN ambassador had to say.
I started at this university. This university has been really the center of protests. When you look back in the 1960s, the 1970s, where there were protests on this campus. And so I welcome people protesting the things that they believe in. I welcome people protesting in disagreement with actions that I might have taken. But I want to be able to respond. And so I usually listen. That's how I keep my cool. I listen to what people have to say. And then I look for an opportunity to express my own views, to defend actions that I might have taken that they feel has contributed to their anger. And that is something that is truly important, and I will say that to you, that you, your views are really important, but you have to be able to listen as well to others. The suffering that is taking place in Gaza right now, no one, not me, not anyone in this room. The cause of the suffering in Gaza was initiated, and I'm going to be very, very honest with you. On October 7th, there were no attacks in Gaza before October 7th. There were no.
Do you know what the Nakba is?
I do. I'm not.
How would you describe what the Nakba is? In your own.
In 1948, I wasn't there, but and neither were you, and we all know what happened. We know what happened.
Campus police say three people were detained. None were affiliated with UW-Madison. We are working to report more of this developing story.
And lastly, big news today for buses. Madison's transportation director has announced his departure. Justin Sturenberg has headed up the city's transportation infrastructure for 5 years, and he's overseen some of the most major shifts in Madison transportation in decades, overseeing the transition to a different bus network map and the shift to bus rapid transit. That's what it is. Sturenberg is leaving to join a private sector consulting firm. Madison Parks Director Eric Knepp will be filling in as acting manager of Metro Transit while a national search is underway.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We'll dive more deeply into campus attitudes towards the Supreme Court election. We'll travel back in time to 1965, and we'll broadcast the most in-depth weather report on the airwaves.
So stay tuned. Back momentarily.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. This year's festival boasts over 170 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. This year we'll be showing films at the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater, as well as four venues on the UW-Madison.
The National Weather Service in Milwaukee-Sullivan has issued a tornado warning for southeastern Columbia County in south-central Wisconsin, north-central Dane County in south-central Wisconsin, until 7 p.m. At 6:30 p.m., a severe thunderstorm capable of producing a tornado was located near DeForest, or near Wanakee, moving northeast at 40 miles an hour. Hazard, tornado. Source, radar indicated rotation. Impact, flying debris will be dangerous to those caught without shelter. Mobile homes will be damaged or destroyed. Damage to roofs, windows, and vehicles will occur. Tree damage is likely. Locations impacted include Otsego, Morrisonville, Arlington, Doylestown, Rio, Dane, DeForest, and Columbus. Take cover now. Move to a basement or an interior room on the lowest floor of a sturdy building. Avoid windows. If you are outdoors, in a mobile home, or in a vehicle, move to the closest substantial shelter and protect yourself from flying debris.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for joining us.
Every Tuesday, we bring you the Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring news from the UW-Madison campus brought to you by student journalists at the Daily Cardinal. In a break from their usual formatting, host Oliver Gerhars sat down yesterday with the Badger Herald's digital news editor, Brianna Davis. They discuss her coverage of Susan Crawford's rally last month at UW-Madison and campus attitudes on the high-profile race for state Supreme Court.
Welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom.
As of the day of recording, April 1st, it is election day for the highly contested state Supreme Court case between Dane County Circuit Judge Susan Crawford and Waukesha County Circuit Judge Brad Schimmel. Today we're joined by the Badger Herald's digital news editor, Brianna Davis, to discuss their story on a rally held by Judge Crawford at UW-Madison last month as part of a larger discussion about campus attitudes towards the state Supreme Court race. Thanks for joining me today, Brianna.
Yes, of course.
So what were some of the issues that Judge Crawford focused on during her speech?
I think a lot of it was just talking about her opponent and where that funding was coming from, because I think that's been a big point of contention for a lot of people for this race, because it's pretty unprecedented for the Wisconsin Supreme Court election to have this much money dumped into it. So she focused a lot on that.
So just for a little bit more context, can you say who's been dumping that money into Brad Schimmel's campaign?
Yes. So it's very interesting. Elon Musk has been very vocal about his support for Judge Brad Schimmel, which is very interesting because this is a nonpartisan race, but he has been tweeting in support and then pouring millions and millions of dollars into Brad Schimmel's campaign and running ads against Susan Crawford. It is completely unprecedented for this much money to go into a Supreme Court election. I think Wisconsin Supreme Court elections do not get this much money. Even like with Janet Protasiewicz a couple years ago, like maybe somewhere around $50 million went into like the overall election. Not positive on that number, but like having probably double that by the end of these races, it's just nothing anybody has seen before.
But aside from this big headlining issue of the money coming towards the Schimmel campaign from Elon Musk, what other topics did Susan Crawford talk about when she was on campus?
I think abortion is a really big topic just around this election because of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So that was definitely something that Crawford was talking about because the 1849 abortion law in Wisconsin is up in the air again. It's murking its way through the courts. So that's been a really big issue for students specifically. So that's definitely something that both her and Schimmel have been under scrutiny for.
With abortion as such a big ticket item in this race, can you tell us a little more about how the Supreme Court, what role they would actually play in deciding the status of abortion in the state?
As of right now, where the law stands, it was decided that it applies to feticide instead of abortion, but it's now working its way through the courts again to like determine if it's applicable again. And both Crawford and Schimmel have addressed it. They both have said that they are going to just apply the law. But aside from that, Crawford has identified herself as a pro-choice individual and Schimmel has identified himself as a pro-life individual. So that's been playing into voters' decisions, I think, a lot.
So at that Crawford rally on campus, how big was the crowd?
It was a lot bigger than I was expecting. It was in Granger Hall, so a big stage type room in there, and it was completely full. There were some people standing along the sides, so maybe, 150, 200 people, which for a random weeknight, it's a pretty decent crowd.
How was the energy at that rally?
It was very, like, very upbeat. There's some, like, reproductive rights activists there and some people from the Wisconsin College Dems that spoke before her. But you could tell that everyone in the room was, like, excited to be there and, like, really wanted to, like, advocate for Crawford because there was a lot of call and response. There was a lot of clapping, just definitely very electric in there.
So during the presidential race, Kamala Harris campaigned in Wisconsin on abortion rights in a similar way that Judge Crawford is. So what's different about the messaging here? Have you seen a different reaction from voters?
I think the messaging is a little bit different because Crawford herself has said that she's not promising anything. The only thing that she's promising to do is apply the law in a fair and impartial way because that's her role as a judge. So I think it's different for a judge versus a presidential candidate because they have two different roles in how this issue would play out. So I think it definitely is a very big deal to voters, and I think that's what's bringing a lot of people to vote for her. But I think there's less of a direct effect than people would think because she can't do anything unless a case is brought before her about the law.
You mentioned that Crawford promises an impartiality as a judge, but does having such a politicized race affect actually getting impartial judges?
Yeah, this is something I actually asked her about after her rally on campus, about how much money is being poured in and like how can people like trust the integrity of an election when it's become so politicized, when it's supposed to be nonpartisan. And what she said was she's unsure of what her opponent's plans are and like what his intentions are if he gets elected, but her plan is just simply to uphold the law and like make decisions on cases in the most fair and impartial way that she can, and that's all she was promising to people.
As of the day of recording, it is election day, so what have you seen on campus? Anything that stuck out to you about that?
Campus is very busy, even more so than normal for just the middle of the school week. There's people everywhere handing out flyers. I had somebody come into my lecture this morning at 8 a.m. that was trying to hand out flyers. You can see like on State Street, there's people tabling everywhere, handing out goodies. Like there's a huge inflatable cow on East Campus Mall, like telling people to vote. People are just trying to get people out to vote. Like no matter who you're voting for, I think that's just the general message of today. Like everyone is just pushing to get people to the polls.
Is there anything else that you've learned over the course of reporting on this state Supreme Court race that we haven't talked about yet in this interview that you'd like to bring up before we close?
I think it's been interesting to see the difference between this election and when Janet Protasiewicz was up for election a couple of years ago. I think the levels of excitement and like the hope on campus is very similar, trying to like keep that liberal majority on the court. And I think that Crawford is definitely leaning into things that Janet did that made her popular with students and really like catering to the student vote, which I think a lot of people are realizing that UW campuses and like getting students out to vote is one of the biggest things that you can do to really make a difference in these kinds of elections. So it's been cool to see like how catered the messages are to students specifically.
Well, thanks for coming on Bridging the Divide this week, Brianna.
Yes, absolutely.
That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
It is time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather expert Rob McClure.
Well, a very eventful day today. The warm front did finally reach Madison, as it turned out, late in the afternoon. That was a bit of a surprise, and so we did jump above 60 degrees. And although I thought we'd be spared any severe weather here because it wasn't going to warm up quite so much, we have seen a couple of thunderstorm cells exhibiting rotation in Dane County over the past hour or so. I'll get on to more of that momentarily. The one of concern presently is north and northeast of Madison up into Columbia County. The corridor of really heavy weather, though, has remained to our south and southeast, where tornadic thunderstorms have been raking across Missouri and Arkansas and southern Illinois and adjacent parts of the lower Mississippi Valley much of the afternoon. Those areas had much warmer and moister air infiltrating the lower layers of the atmosphere, providing a source of much stronger upward motion for thunderstorms. To balance the very strong wind shear that's currently present actually across much of the Midwest, that sort of wind shear introduces a lot of angular momentum into the lower atmosphere, and if you've got strong updrafts in addition, that can produce supercell or rotating thunderstorms. Our lack of instability, however, here has generally meant that thunderstorms have had a hard time getting going this afternoon and have otherwise been confined vertically to just 20,000 feet or so, or a little bit more, when they have gotten up and running. So showers mostly this afternoon until the warm front went through, and we have seen a couple of thunderstorms burst up in the period since then. The brisk wind speeds up above us, which you can get a nice sense of by looking at the visible satellite image of southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, are courtesy of an intense low to mid-level cyclone that's lifting northeastward through southern Minnesota this evening. So the circulation center is just off the image to the left if you're looking at that. Wind speeds are up to towards 50 miles per hour, just a couple thousand feet overhead, and you can see the convective clouds on that visible image sweeping rapidly northeast as they curl ever so slightly inward towards the low. Indeed, you can see how the gradual convergence into that low does help to produce some sort of some linear bands of clouds and showers running northward of the type that we're often familiar with in these storms. The water vapor image of the contiguous U.S. also, which is also linked on the WORT weather webpage, will give you another good depiction of just the how strong this storm is at the upper levels, and also the speed at which the upper level impulse producing the surface circulation, which is visible near the end of the sequence as a darkened area lifting northeastward from western Kansas towards northern Wisconsin, how fast that's now moving away from us. The storm will exit across Lake Superior tonight and on across Quebec tomorrow, so that will eventually relax the pressure gradient while also drawing in some cooler air from southern Canada over the next couple of days. The jet stream will continue to be laid out southwest to northeast, basically, over us or nearby us to our southeast over the coming few days, so that should keep the atmosphere generally subsidened, at least after the next couple hours, and skies clear to partly cloudy over the coming days. Unfortunately, it's also going to keep us in line for the next major impulse coming along the jet, and that looks to line up pretty much for the period from about late Friday afternoon into Saturday morning. There's a healthy amount of disagreement still across the forecast models for the track of this next one, but its precipitation does look to mostly be confined to our southeast, although the Canadian and North American models in particular show that precipitation working as far northwest as Madison during the overnight. The rest of the weekend, though, is generally looking dry after that. We'll be colder then in the medium term out into the early part of next week with a 2 or 3 day blast of colder air coming in from Canada, but a more significant warming trend does look to be on the cards as we get to the later part of next week. But back to this evening, passing showers and again some thunderstorms will continue to race northeastward across the area through the mid-evening hours. As I look at the radar currently, the thunderstorm of concern is up in Columbia County. There has been rotation with one of those cells. I can't see if it's moved off the image currently because the storms are moving quite rapidly to the northeast, approaching 50 miles per hour. So keep following the National Weather Service's warnings for this one. They may have already been canceled. Temperatures will drop steadily as we go through the overnight, down through the 50s and 40s, down to the upper 30s on southwesterly winds at 12 to 18 miles per hour, slowly veering more westerly and staying fairly brisk through the night. Skies will remain with passing high and mid-level cloud cover. Tomorrow, cloud conditions may be a little bit of a tough call, but I'm expecting just passing high and mid-level clouds primarily, possibly with some cumulus growth down lower as well. Temperatures will reach the mid to upper 40s on westerly winds at 12 to 20 miles per hour, slowly veering northwest and coming down to about 5 to 10 miles per hour by evening. Skies will continue partly cloudy in the overnight, with temperatures dropping towards the low 30s. Light winds will veer more northerly overnight, then northeast and more easterly as we get into Friday. And Friday may be partly sunny to start, but with steadily increasing high clouds as we get later in the day, probably lowering by evening and perhaps even beginning to sport some showers. Those would be likeliest to the south and southeast of Madison. Precipitation chances as we go then overnight will also remain highest in the southeast parts of the listening area, with lower chances and less cloud cover even the further northwest you go. Temperatures will reach 50 or so Friday with easterly winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour, banking more northeasterly again as we go through the overnight, and temperatures will drop to around 40 or so, or perhaps the upper 30s in that overnight. Saturday, rains, whatever we might see of them, should work eastward out of the area in the morning hours, and with some luck, we may see some breaking of the cloud cover later on, lifting if nothing else. Temperatures will be somewhat cloud-dependent, but we should approach 50, I think. Northerly winds will be up at 8 to 12 miles per hour. Temperatures will drop towards the low 30s then in the overnight with partly cloudy skies, and Sunday we'll see similar high temperatures, somewhere up around 50, with just passing cloud cover that day. At the moment, down here at the station on Bedford Street, the temperature is 61 degrees. The dew point temperature is 56. Winds are fairly light now, south at 5 miles per hour. Passing convective clouds visible to the northwest of the station. Last I looked out, those have probably cleared by now since those storms are moving quite quickly to the northeast. The radar is fairly clear now from Madison south and west. The barometer is falling at 29.29 inches of mercury.
Time is now 6:50 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We go now to April 1965. When students learned about the war in Vietnam, voters chose a liberal mayor, and the city pondered the lasting effects of racism. Stu Levitan has the headlines from 60 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All these combined. They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, April 1965. The month opens with a political point-counterpoint. In the Social Sciences Building, several thousand students cram the corridors and classrooms for a 10-hour teach-in about the war in Vietnam. It's instigated by sociology professor William Sewell and organized by the Faculty Student Committee to End the War in Vietnam. From 2 p.m. until after midnight, 26 prominent faculty, including Professors Merle Curdy, George Massey, and Germaine Brie, give lectures and lead discussions on the causes and effects of the war. And more than 1,000 pack into room 230 for the concluding panel, starring Professor William Appleman Williams. The Wisconsin Alumnus Magazine, noting the nearly unanimous opposition to the war from all the speakers, is not impressed. Quote, "The overall result was to combine lectures with political harangues, a rational and responsible effort at constructive criticism of American foreign policy was impossible under these unfortunate circumstances." The week-long protests culminate the next day in a noon rally of about 1,000 on Library Mall, featuring remarks by Sewell, Williams, and former National Security Council analyst Marcus Raskin. While the teaching is underway in social sciences, over at the law school, the Committee to Support the People of South Vietnam holds rally of about 200, featuring acclaimed war photojournalist Dickie Chappelle, sister of geology professor Richard Meyer. The Shorewood native, who's covered war since World War II, says she's, quote, honored to attend the first counter-demonstration in support of the war. Chappelle has spent more than a year in Vietnam and is soon to return on assignment for the National Observer, after which she plans to retire. The Committee to Support the People of South Vietnam, led by a half dozen students active in fraternities and campus politics, also drafts a petition in support of the American war effort. In 4 days, they collect 6,000 signatures. On April 25th, committee leaders visit the White House, where they present the petitions to presidential aide McGeorge Bundy, the national security advisor who recommended the February bombing raids that sparked the formation of the Committee to End the War in Vietnam. As they present the petition, about 250 picket outside the gates in a protest organized by the Students for a Democratic Society. The UW campus is also the scene in early April for shows by musical legends. On the 2nd, Count Basie headlines the military ball in the Great Hall, admission $350 per couple. On the 9th, Jerry Lee Lewis proves he is still the killer at the Alpha Epsilon Pi Ape Party, featuring a bevy of jungle maidens. Sunday night, April 4th, Joseph Bufo Cianigli is working at his uncle Frank Skiro's liquor store on Regent Street. Bufo needs to go in the back, so Frank's brother Dominic Skiro, that's Madison Police Detective Dominic Skiro, is watching the store. That's when a masked gunman, Nathan Lee Thomas, comes in, demands all the money, and fires straight at him. It is only the leather-encased metal badge in Skiro's inner coat pocket that blocks the bullet from his chest. Skiro subdues and arrests Thomas, who's sentenced to 8 years for armed robbery, but found not guilty of attempted murder. Apparently because Skiro's station house comments to reporters after the incident apparently differed from his trial testimony. Incensed that press reports thus affected the verdict, Police Chief Wilbur Emery restricts press access at police headquarters for the foreseeable future. On the 6th, voters call for a changing of the political guard at City Hall as liberal Dane County Clerk Otto Feske wins a landslide victory to succeed conservative Mayor Henry Reynolds. Feske carries 19 of 22 wards in beating conservative Republican businessman and former Reynolds campaign manager George Hall. Feske lays out an ambitious agenda in his inaugural address on April 20th. Settle the fee dispute with the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation over the abandoned Monona Terrace and start a new auditorium process. Identify and acquire land for what he calls the sorely needed Eastside Hospital. Meet the, quote, great need for improved public transportation. Establish a Madison Area Planning and Policy Advisory Committee for teamwork to pursue greater cooperation and coordination with area municipalities. And improve relations with the university. The dismal state of town-gown relations is also a big concern to outgoing Daily Cardinal editor Gail Bensinger, quote, I don't really understand just why students are so generally disliked here, but people are antagonistic and make no effort to hide their resentment. And she notes with outrage the, quote, deplorable conditions and the outrageous rents of student housing. We students are hated and criticized by many, she concludes her valedictory editorial, quote, and we pay through the nose for it. A sobering report from the City Equal Opportunities Commission on the vicious cycle of racism, quote, the principle of open housing has been generally accepted, but because Negroes do not have the economic resources to move to better neighborhoods, there has been a concentration in certain areas. Equal employment opportunities are also accepted in principle, but in many cases Negroes are not qualified for jobs available. Therefore, in Madison, there is not basically a question of denying civil rights as such, but there is the problem of Negroes being unable to attain equal status because of a lack of resources. This, in turn, means lack of qualifications, education, training, and consequently poorer jobs and lower pay. This makes for a vicious circle. Negroes live in poorer and more crowded homes, which leads to greater delinquency and crime, more broken homes, less preparation for jobs, a higher ratio than whites on relief, and in aid to dependent children. Therefore, we have more than a civil rights problem. We have an economic problem, a relief problem, a slum problem, and a tax-based problem, all of which affects the city. And as the month ends, President Johnson ends a long-standing and embarrassing struggle over the federal judgeship for the Western District of Wisconsin by appointing James E. Doyle Sr., former chair of the Democratic Party and a former vice president of the Madison Police and Fire Commission, to the bench. Doyle, whose wife Ruth is vice president of the Madison School Board and a former state legislator, is confirmed in 3 weeks and sworn in June 22nd. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And just briefly before we go, an update on the weather and the thunderstorm cell that inspired the tornado warning in northern Dane County and in Columbia County is now north of Columbus and will be north of Beaver Dam, approaching Waupun over the next half hour. It does look like the rotation in that storm has waned. Nevertheless, you might keep your eye out for that one. That does it for our show. Otherwise, thanks for listening to the WORT Live Local News at 6. Our headline writers this evening were Greg Sanderson, Sutton Johnson, and Jack Goodman. Dane Bulow, was your reporter, along with additional reporting from Tony Castaneda this evening and Kate Poppy. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Oliver Gerhartz, Ted Hinkstrom, and Stu Levitan. Katie Gergella is our on-air engineer. Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
I'm Governor Evers, and I'm listening to WORT Madison.
Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. To find out more information or apply, go to WORTFM.org/talkhost.
Hi friends, we have an event announcement for you. Out Professional Engagement Network, or OPEN, is a Madison-based nonprofit that welcomes all LGBTQIA2S+ humans and allied individuals. They are community-centered and career-driven individuals who are committed to building equitable and inclusive experiences, workplaces, events, and opportunities.